Hello, and welcome to the Anxiety RX podcast, a show created by an anxiety specialist and neuroscientist, me, that offers unique, practical, and actionable advice to help you understand what anxiety truly is and exactly what you can do to empower yourself to resolve it. I'm your host, Dr. Russell Kennedy, an MD who suffered with crippling anxiety for 30-plus years, and traditional therapy from psychiatrists and psychologists really didn't help me feel better. And I also didn't like being on psych meds. In 2013, after burning out and leaving medical practice, I came to the conclusion that if I was ever going to heal my anxiety, I would have to do it myself. And that's exactly what I did, drawing from experiences with psychedelics and holistic healing, and combining those modalities with my scientific academic background in medicine, neuroscience, and developmental psychology. Here on the Anxiety RX podcast, I offer a distinctly non-traditional and non-medical approach to understanding and healing anxiety. So despite the fact I'm trained as a physician, in no way is what I say and suggest to be construed as medical advice, because none of the ways I use to resolve anxiety has anything to do with traditional allopathic medicine. From my own healing, I've created a distinctly non-traditional understanding and approach that helps thousands of people from all over the world understand and relieve their chronic anxiety. So if you're ready, let's get into today's episode. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Anxiety RX podcast. I'm having technical issues today, but as you guys know, I was a stand-up comic for many years, so I'm going to roll with this, and I'm really excited today to have Dr. David Spiegel with me. I saw his interview with Andrew Huberman and was just blown away. It was so amazing. That's like, I've got to get him on the show. So Dr. David Spiegel serves as the Wilson Professor and Associate Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine, and is the director for both the Center on Stress and Health and the Center for Integrative Medicine. Dr. Spiegel's contributions encompass 13 published books, 425 scientific journal articles, and 175 book chapters spanning hypnosis, psychosocial oncology, there's a one for you, stress physiology, trauma, and psychotherapy for stress, anxiety, yay, and depression. He is also the co-founder and chief scientific officer of revolutionary self-hypnosis app, Reverie. David, I hope I can call you David. Thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Russ. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Yeah. So as I said, I watched your episode with Andrew Huberman a number of times, and I was surprised to learn that your father was also in the same line of work that you are.
Right. It's a sort of a genetic illness in my family, actually.
Well, it's funny you should mention genetic illness, because that was my father. My father was bipolar and schizophrenic. And that's the reason I wrote the book, I think, is because I lived with him and he was never abusive or violent or anything like that, but he would go into mania and he would go into depression and psychotic depressions. And when you're a child and you watch your father figure just crumble before your eyes like that, it was really anxiety provoking for me and traumatic for me. So I developed an anxiety disorder. And what I used to be anxious about was developing schizophrenia or bipolar. So I used to tell myself, look, if you get to 25, you're probably going to be okay. And then I would say, I got to 25. It's like, okay, if you get to 30, you're probably okay. And then it wasn't until I hit 35 that I really thought, okay, well, I probably dodged that bullet. But in worrying so much that I was going to become bipolar, I developed an anxiety disorder. So that's kind of that background.
I'm here to tell you, you've reached the threshold and you're fine.
Yeah.
But you know, what strikes me actually, Russ, is that you developed the anxiety he should have had. You know, the thing about people with bipolar disorder, especially when they're high, is nothing bothers them. You know,
yes.
They think you got a problem. They don't have a problem.
Yep.
And so you provided the compensatory anxiety that might have slowed him down had the illness not prevented him from doing that, you know, so.
Yeah, really interesting.
But it's tough.
I noticed that when I was on MDMA, because it sounds like I'm a big drug addict, but I've done like psychedelics and different sort of stuff about five times in my life. And the last time was 10 years ago. But I remember being on MDMA and being in the middle of a really anxious phase. And on MDMA, I would have the thought, but it had no salience to me. It had no register in there. So it was just like, oh yeah, you know, you could die of cancer or whatever the worry du jour was. And it just didn't bother me.
Right. Well, I think what MDMA does and what hypnosis does in a more controlled and transient way, Russ, is it turns down activity in two parts of the brain, both connected to the anterior cingulate cortex. And the anterior part is part of our salience network. It's our worry center. It helps you decide, oh, you know, you hear a loud noise, you know, you say, I better deal with it. It matches patterns. And when an unusual pattern comes along, it tells you, watch out. In hypnosis, you turn down activity in that part of the brain considerably. And in fact, that part of the brain's our own little hypnopharmacy, because highly hypnotizable people have greater binding of GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, to in the anterior cingulate cortex. So you've got your own self-generated benzodiazepine-like state where you're inhibiting GABA. That's what you're stimulating
activating GABA
inhibit
GABA,
activity. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, benzos do that. They're GABA agonists. The other part is the posterior cingulate cortex, which is part of the default mode network. It's a key node there. And the default mode is where you do what you're talking about. You formulate who you are, what people think about you, what's expected of you. And many of the psychedelics like MDMA, psilocybin, inhibit activity in the posterior cingulate cortex. And you get this, what's called ego dissolution. You just stop being who you are and you just experience things for what they are. And in hypnosis, to the extent that you're executive control network, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is active, you're inhibiting activity in the posterior cingulate. And that's where you're sort of freeing yourself up to be whoever the hell you want to be and see what it feels like.
Right.
So rather than understanding it or something, you just say, let's see what it would be like if. And that's a terrific therapeutic context in which you can just try out being different, just the way you felt with MDMA, only you don't necessarily need to use the drug, although the psychedelics are very interesting.
They really are. You know, I have this little acronym that I use called JABS, which is basically self-judgment, self-abandonment, self-blame, and self-shame, right? And this is something that people often call this the inner critic. Now, the posterior cingulate, from what I understand about it, is kind of like involved in self-referential thought. You know, right. And negativity and like the inner critic. So when you take a psychedelic, you kind of paralyze the PCC and you paralyze that kind of inner critic and you get to, you know, see yourself as you really are, which I find really interesting.
Or I put it differently. You see yourself as you really might be.
Okay.
That you don't have to be what you think you are or what you think other people think you should be. Mm. You can just try out what it's like to be different. And you know, that's the thing that people fear the most about hypnosis, Russ, is, you know, and, you know, everybody's been to one of these dumb stage shows where the football coach dances like a ballerina and all that. And I don't like it. I don't like making fools of people in front of audiences. But it makes the point that here's a guy trying out being someone and something he never, ever thought he would be and seeing what it feels like. He probably decided not to become a ballerina afterward.
You would think.
He could give it a try. And that's one of the things that is actually so cool about hypnosis, is that you can just suspend your usual orientation to who you are and what you are and see what it's like to be different.
Yeah, I have this little concept that I've been working on lately called sort of pendulating dissociation. So it's kind of like when you're talking about with Dr. Huberman there about going into that dissociative state, the woman who is about attempted raped, you know, she went into this dissociated state. And I think we have to go in and visit that dissociated state, but we also have to do it in an atmosphere of safety, because nothing changes, I believe, in the brain and my somatic training and that kind of, nothing really changes unless you develop this, have this sort of fertile ground of safety to kind of build things on. Which is one of the reasons why I think cognitive therapy, just changing your thoughts, oh, you know, it wasn't so bad, whatever, doesn't really change anything. So that's one of the things I love about hypnosis, is that you're providing this grounded, safe environment, you know, you're floating, whatever it is that you use. Right. And you're also sort of, now can we dip our toe in that trauma? And now can we come back into safety? Can we go back? Because that pendulation, that back and forth, that almost titrated dissociation, I believe is where we start metabolizing this whole trauma.
I think you're absolutely right. And there's two pieces to that, Russ. One is that you do create the sense of safety from the body up rather than the brain down.
Totally.
Experience your body floating in a bath, a lake, a hot tub, or floating in space. Let your body feel safe and comfortable. So that's the ground rule. We may think about things that we're threatening, but the first rule is your body is safe and comfortable. So you're physically protected and your physiological concerns are reasonable, but we're going to make sure you feel safe. And then the other side of it is, you know, I've always wondered, you know, one of the major treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder is exposure therapy. You know, you have people expose themselves. And I'm thinking, well, then why don't flashbacks cure PTSD? You know, you're exposed, God knows. And they don't. They make it worse.
Right.
But here's the thing. You're doing it, as you described it, in a controlled way.
Right.
You're choosing to address it, whereas the essence of trauma is helplessness. It's feeling like an object, a thing. You lose agency. And so the things that are helpful are things where, yes, you're dealing with the trauma, as we did in that case that I discussed on Andrew Huberman's podcast, but you're doing it in a way that you control the situation and you can see things about it that were evident, but you weren't aware of while it was happening. And that's what she did in that situation. So,
yeah, I mean, what I really enjoyed about that was just being able to go into that dissociated state, that painful state, and then her saying, what was something positive about that? What was something self-protective about that? Which was, I said, I felt like, you know, I surprised him with how much I fought back. So, you know, with me, when I deal with my anxiety people, including me, is that, you know, I've never met anybody with significant anxiety who didn't have a victim mentality, right? So victim mentality is kind of like associated with that sense of helplessness as well, because when you're a victim, nothing appears like you have any agency. And anything that goes in the way, it's like the little thing that I write about, there's a guy in the middle of the town square and he's hitting himself with a hammer, you know, all day. And then someone comes up and says to him, why do you hit yourself with a hammer all the time? And the guy says, because it feels so good when I stop. You know, it's just anything that goes in the other direction that's anti-victim is starting to move you into that place where you had some agency, you had some ability to kind of bring it in. And I think this is where kind of cold plunges really make a difference for people too, because they're in this painful environment, yet, like I did this at Whistler like last summer. It's like, but I put myself here and I knew that I was putting myself here. And there was something very therapeutic about putting myself into pain that I had some agency over.
Exactly. The agency is crucial, that I'm doing it. And that's, you know, that can be very problematic, hitting yourself with a hammer or people who get into or stay in abusive relationships.
Totally.
Know, because they think, you know, if I only don't, you know, piss them off or drop a dish or something, you know, I'll be in control. And of course, they never are. Mm. And so you're absolutely right that the agency is crucial. And so it's one of these interesting paradoxes, Russ, that the very thing that scares people the most about hypnosis, I will lose control, they'll make me do anything they want, is really a way of enhancing control, of experiencing your agency and using it to help yourself control your body and its arousal and tension, and also face and understand situations that caused you trouble before from a whole new point of view.
Yeah, creating what you said, like a mental state change. You know, I don't think that we use that enough in therapy. I think there is a tremendous therapeutic benefit in creating this mental state change, especially if the client or patient or whatever we call them has some agency in that, has some say in it. Like, I can't, this is where self-hypnosis, I guess, comes in.
That's
is that
exactly
you, you can do this.
Right. All hypnosis is really self-hypnosis. Mm. What I'm doing is showing you how to use it. And that's why reverie works. I mean, you know, 40 years ago, I wouldn't have thought that I would dare, you know, build an app that would let people anywhere, anytime hypnotize themselves. And, you know, we've had virtually no trouble with it at all. And either if they get better or they don't. But it's something that extends people's ability to manage themselves, manage their bodies, manage their minds. And we're showing them how to enhance their control. Here are the tools. Here's what you need to do. I'll guide you through an experience of it, and then you can learn to use it for yourself.
Because I think I know a lot of the people that I deal with as children, they had a tremendous amount of uncertainty and no real control because there were children. So when you give people this sense of control and it's replicable, they can create this for themselves. It becomes this, you know, self positive, this virtuous cycle, as opposed to the what I call the alarm anxiety cycle, which is the old trauma that you experienced as a child that wasn't metabolized by your parents or caregivers. It's still in you. And it still reverberates through your brain, and it creates this sense of anxiety because your mind is a compulsive meaning-making, make-sense machine. So through interoception, if you feel this alarm that's still stuck in you, whether it's in your body, your mind, or whatever, you will make up thoughts that are completely consistent with how you feel. So then you create this worrisome thought, which of course accentuates the alarm, which of course paralyzes your prefrontal cortex. So you lose the rational ability to see these ridiculous worries are ridiculous. And then you come back 2 hours later, it's like, why did I get so upset about that? Like, why was that such a horrible worry? And right now it's like, doesn't bother me at all.
Right. Well, part of it, I think, is the sense of involuntariness that, you know, sort of, I left the door open and the unwelcome guest came in and I'm stuck with him. Rather than saying, I'm creating a mental environment in which I can remain physically comfortable and I can choose who I'm going to talk to and who not. So I'm creating the change in mental state. I'm inviting this and I can invite him out again when I'm done with it. It gives, and that's one of the things that I find so interesting about using hypnosis, even for people who have suffered terrible trauma, is that they can feel in control of turning it on. If you turn it on, you can turn it off. I had a Vietnam veteran, a wonderful guy, who adopted a Vietnamese orphan when he was over there. And they were very happy together. He was the youngest of like 13 children. And so he identified with being a kid, but also with looking after the kid in a very dangerous situation. And tragically, he came home one day during the Tet Offensive and found the kid had been killed in a bomb attack on the hospital. And he just lost it. He was out in the jungle shooting at people, and he wound up in a mental hospital for a year. And when I saw him, I said, I think we need to deal with the boy's death. Mm. And so I had him, he was very hypnotizable, had him go into hypnosis. And I said, I want you to picture what happened when you found him. And he said, oh, I should have just taken you to the hooch. If you hadn't been here, man, you'd be alive. It's all my fault. He's saying that's all my fault. And I said, and I had him picture the funeral, and he just, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. You would think that's as bad as it can get. Mm. And then I said, there's another screen on the other side, and I want you to picture sometime you were really happy with him. And a big grin comes on his face. And he said, it was his birthday. And my sister sent a toy train to him. They'd never seen a train before. Mm. And we had this big birthday party and he was so happy. And I said to him, well, you know, it's tragic. You're facing the fact that he was killed and he died, but you had a period of real joy with him. And that's real too. And you still have that. And he came out of the hypnosis a few minutes later, and I said, what are you picturing? And he said, I see a grave and a cake. Mm. Grave and a cake. And so he got the concept,
right,
that's the way people grieve. You know, it hurts so much because of what you've lost, but you had that, you know, for a period of time. And it's similar to things that people report taking psilocybin when they're dying of cancer. You know, initially I thought that's a bad idea. You know, I've worked with dying cancer patients forever, but who would want to have a bad trip when you're thinking about dying? Mm. But they come back saying, you know, I finally looked at my death. I could understand my non-being, but I could also appreciate what a miracle it is that I was ever alive at all. Mm. And that doesn't go away. And these people, after one or two sessions like that, they feel different about dying. So, and I think there's a similar mechanism, the sort of ego dissolution or ego suspension, you know, where you just experience things from a different point of view and it changes you.
Yeah. You know, I have this little, you know, sort of clinical neuroscientific thought, just because I believe that the insula has a tremendous amount to do with anxiety. So I think what happens, the insula, this is my little theory, is that the insula and the amygdala and the anterior cingulate to some extent, and probably PAG, connect together to create this emotional signature of trauma. So if you were being beaten by your dad when you were six, or your mother was drunk or whatever, there is an emotional signature of that laid down in your system. And every time that you go into that feeling, you will age regress and go into that anxiety. You'll have the same kind of wherewithal you did when at the time of the trauma. So if we can go in and revisit that actual feeling in the body and change that feeling, change it through the insula, change it through the amygdala, you would kind of give it a little bit of a lobotomy. You know, we give it another chance to kind of go, hey, you know what? There's another way. You don't have to get locked in to this survival mechanism where this was the tunnel vision. This was your only path out as a child was to do this, probably dissociate or make the same story over and over again. Now, if we can change that story or give it what you call the second screen, if we can put that in there, we kind of start, you know, giving that little area a little bit of a lobotomy and changing it a little bit. And then if you're in a safe already environment, that's fertile ground for us to change that emotional signature of that pain. And when you change the emotional signature, you start opening up to a place where they can actually see they have agency in their own change.
Yes, I think you're right, but I would avoid the lobotomy image. It was not one of the brighter periods of recent psychiatric history.
That's true.
And, you know, one of the guys that did that actually got a Nobel Prize in like 1949, God help us. But I think you're absolutely right. The insula is deeply involved. It's part of the salience network along with the anterior cingulate. And it is the major mind-body pathway.
Totally.
So, and what happens in hypnosis, we've seen using functional MRI, is higher functional connectivity between the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, particularly on the left. So we want to keep it connected, and the insula. So it's a pathway by which you can consciously change the way your body's acting and also consciously perceive what's going on in your body. And that's what creates this reverberating cycle of, oh my God, you know, that sense of helplessness and I'm picturing something awful happening and you feel it in your body. And then you think, oh my God, this must be really bad because my body feels so terrible. Mm-hmm. And you get more anxious and it's like a snowball rolling downhill. With hypnosis, you can use that enhanced DLPFC control over the insula to help your body feel better instead of worse. And you're already experiencing more agency and control because you're controlling how your body is feeling. We did a study once. I mean, the degree of control is really can be remarkable, where we brought people in first thing in the morning, no breakfast, NPO, and had them eat imaginary meals. And my colleague Ken Klein put an NG tube down and measured gastric acid. So for an hour, they were picturing taking a gastronomic tour of the Bay Area. And one woman after half an hour said, "Let's stop, I'm full."
That's how powerful it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And 89% increase in gastric acid secretion, just eating imaginary food. So then we had them do anything pleasant except eat or drink. So they were on a desert island somewhere, sunbathing or swimming or something. And we got a 39% decrease in gastric acid secretion. So the brain could change it both ways in hypnosis. And then Ken said, well, you know, I want to inject them with pentagastrin, which it triggers maximal parietal cell output of acid. We did that. We still had a 19% decrease in gastric acid secretion during hypnosis compared to a control condition. So the brain can do things to the body that we just don't realize. We don't understand how well it can do it. And hypnosis really lights up those pathways. So it's positive mutual activation of the DLPFC and the insula controlling those mind-body sensations. Inverse functional connectivity with the default mode network, with the posterior cingulate cortex. Right. So you're inhibiting what you usually think you are and ought to be.
Right.
And decreased activity in the dorsal anterior cingulate, which is your alarm system. So it's a way of just turning down your tendency to become over-alarmed. And that's a natural state of receptive concentration that you can use to deal with problems like this.
Yeah, and I guess in a way, it's like creating those two screens, right? Like the trauma side, and then there's the sort of parasympathetic side as well. And it's like mixing the two together. And what I notice when I work with people is that it's almost like there's a light switch that goes off. It's like, okay, no, now I feel like I don't have that same triggering thought, or I have the thought, but it doesn't have that same reaction in my body. right?
Well, you've restructured it. And if I may tell your listeners a little bit more about that story, sure, about that woman, she came to get hypnosis. It was an attempted rape, and it was getting dark. She couldn't quite see. She wanted to see if she could get a better image of her face. Well, that didn't happen. It was dark. She didn't.
Of the attacker's face.
Of the attacker's face, right. Okay. But she said, she realized something that you might say, Spiegel, you're making her worse, because she said, you know what? He doesn't just want to rape me. He wants to kill me. If he gets me upstairs, he's going to kill me. And she then, on the other side of the screen, so, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, oh, my God, you know, is this going to leave her worse off rather than
yes,
better?
Exactly.
And then on the other side, I said, what did you do to protect yourself? And she said, you know what? He's surprised that I'm fighting this hard. He didn't think I would. So it went, she transformed the meaning of what was a horribly stressful thing from, oh, my God, I nearly died, which was the truth, to, I probably saved my life. Because she had actually, she'd suffered a basilar skull fracture fighting him. And she was feeling guilty that she got herself hurt so badly. And she came away with a totally different viewpoint, that what she did saved her life. And so it's a matter of changing the imprint of the traumatic event to include things that can make you feel better about yourself rather than worse. And I happened to discuss this case at a recent symposium in the Department of Psychology on trauma and PTSD and how we help people with it. And this brilliant young faculty member said, you know, I've been worried about a narrative in treating people who are traumatized, which is that they're just broken and you try and patch them up. And he said, this story is one in which, in some way, she learned something about herself that enhanced her view of herself. So she was better than she was before in that way, that she knew she had a kind of resilience and courage that she didn't know she had. And I think so the thing about that, Russ, it's not just a sort of, you know, putting salve on a wound. It's rebuilding your view of yourself, given the experiences you've had, and genuinely making it better in some ways. It's terrible that it happened, but since it did, you now know something about yourself you didn't know before.
And it was always there. I think that's the thing too. When we show people, this was always there. You know, I have a lot of people that say, oh, Dr. Kennedy, like, can you fix me? You know, and it's like, this is coming from you. And I go kind of into my own background a little bit, because what happened with me and my dad was, my dad for the first 10 years of my life was, you know, a protector. He taught me how to throw a ball. He was a renowned baseball coach. And I really gave him my heart. And then, you know, as I got into my teenage years and he became more psychotic and more suicide attempts and all this kind of stuff, I had to pull back from him. So I kind of, the little internal program that I got was, hey, Rusty, which is my childhood nickname, it's not safe to trust love. That was my thing, right? So what I find with anxiety is that everybody already loves themselves, but what we do is we put in these blocks. And I think the PCC, the posterior cingulate, has something to do with that as well.
That's right.
This judgment, abandonment, blame, and shame. So what we're doing essentially is we're pulling the blocks out to love, to what's already there already. And then when they see it, it starts this kind of different wave of like, yeah, I can see myself in this different light. And I'm sure hypnosis helps you kind of bridge those two gaps of like, this is my cognitive self, and this is my sort of more spiritual, ethereal self. Because I think we're mind, body, spirit. And I think in medicine, in allopathic medicine, we're good at mind and we're good at body, but we're not really that great at the spirit stuff.
Well, I'd put it the other way. We're good at body and okay with mind and forget the spirit.
I was trying to be nice.
Yeah. No, but it's really true. You know, I think that one of the reasons that hypnosis, as well as psychotherapy and psychiatry, are so underappreciated is that we have this mechanical model of what treatment is: ingestion, injection, incision.
Wow.
You know, it's like, the body and the person's a broken car. Just replace the parts, you know.
Yeah.
And that's not what care is all about. And we have this 3-pound organ sitting on our shoulders that is the major evolutionary advantage humans have. It's connected to every part of the body. But, you know, it doesn't come with a user's manual. We don't do all the things it can do because we don't know about it.
Right. Yeah. And then we block it too. Like we block, I think that's a lot of this victim mentality that I see with so many of my anxiety people is that it becomes a way of life for them. It becomes the way they look at themselves. And every day, when you see yourself as a victim every day, even unconsciously, even just automatically, it just reinforces this sense of non-agency, of this helplessness, of this lack of control that you talk about. And, you know, it's almost like Joe Dispenza says, like, break the habit of being yourself, right? It's just, that's why we go on vacation a lot of times and we feel differently because we're not following that same program every day. We see these things every day.
Right. Well, they're secure in their insecurity.
That's, yes.
You know, it's familiar. And that's right. It's why we go on vacation. And what I'm saying is hypnosis, you can take a mini vacation without going anywhere or bothering with a travel agent. You know, you can just see what it's like.
Nice. You don't have to worry about somebody sitting beside you on the plane that is not that great. Yeah.
The person sitting beside you is you. Mm.
The other screen. Yeah. So right. Exactly. I just think it's so fascinating to see how we're coming full circle, even in medicine. There, you know, psychiatrists, doctors, we're starting to kind of see that mind-body connection a lot more rather than, you know, I remember when I toured as a comedian, one of my favorite people to tour with was Kevin Fox, and he told me, I could tell this story, but Kevin used to smoke. Probably still does. And he wanted me to give him an acid blocker, a proton pump inhibitor because when he smoked, of course, it relaxes the muscle at the top of the stomach and all the acid washes up in the stomach and he gets esophagitis. So I said, well, let me get this straight, Kev. You want me to give you a medication so you can keep smoking? And he said, yeah. So I did. Yeah. Yeah. So,
you know, shame on you.
I know. But it's funny. Like I have this other saying too. Like when you, that's the old Freudian repetition compulsion, right? What was normal for you in childhood, you'll unconsciously replicate in adulthood. And I see that with my anxiety people all the time. Yeah. And I have this little saying. I said, you know, because we equate familiarity with security, if your family was dysfunctional, you can break the word familiar down to family and liar because your family kind of lies to you as to how to have a relationship, which is why I've been divorced twice, right? So it's one of those things you just kind of have to look at and sort of see, okay, how can I create something different? And I think it's very difficult for people to consciously, it's just such hard work. Yeah. To consciously change. And I think that's why things like hypnosis, when you feel like something is in you that is already there that you're just bringing out and that you can do it for yourself, because so many, like I said, of my anxiety people feel like victims. When you start getting some agency, man, it's a drug too.
It absolutely is. You remind me of a woman who goes to a couples therapist and said, we have my boyfriend and I have the classic love-hate relationship. We both love him and we both hate me.
Yeah, I remember doing a joke like that. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Did you? So, you know, Freud actually gave up hypnosis. He started his work using hypnosis to trace back problems to their origin in the patient's history. And he was helping a woman be relieved of her attacks of pain by tracing them back to trauma in her early life history. And suddenly, she opens her eyes and throws her arms around his neck and starts hugging him. And Freud wrote in his autobiography, I was modest enough not to attribute this event to my own irresistible personal attractiveness. And I discovered the mysterious element beneath hypnosis, and that was transference, you know, that people transferred feelings from childhood, just as you're describing. And it's too bad because there's some truth to that, but if he'd been able to handle the positive transference better, he might have kept exploring something that is very powerful and can help people come to peace with real old situations in a new way that doesn't keep them just repeating them. You know, the repetition compulsion, you're right.
And just to sort of switch gears for a second here, I'm on the Huberman podcast, you talked about trigger warnings and how we're kind of, we're creating this sort of sanitized society that we don't get any ability to handle, we don't need practice at negative emotion. And on top of that, we're trained retail therapy. We're trained, if you feel negatively, hey, just think positively, just do this. And the thing, the other thing about grief is, you know, because I see a lot of anxious people that basically the cause of their anxiety is just unresolved grief. And they're just not processing it. So there is this thing, you got to feel it to heal it. Like you have to be able to go in there. And I think that's one of the things I love about hypnosis. I wonder if you could comment on creating this kind of safe place in hypnosis to kind of change those old patterns.
Sure, absolutely. I'd be glad to do that. I think what I've experienced, and I've used hypnosis with about 7,000 people in my career. So
wow.
I know a fair amount about it. And I've had a few people who, you know, I remember one woman who, as soon as I hypnotized her, she pictured her husband being pulled off a donkey and beaten by the police and things like that. And I helped her deal with it and her, you know, understandable upset about it, but also what she did to try and help her husband. And, you know, he survived it. And it was fixable. It pointed to a problem that needed fixing. It was not doing her damage. And that's the problem with trigger warnings. You know, the only trigger warnings that I'm in favor of are when the trigger's connected to a gun. Then you need a warning. Otherwise, you know, it people grow and learn from dealing with these things. And I think that hypnosis has such virtue in part because you're showing people. There's one thing, I don't know if you've seen it. This was not in the podcast, but there's a YouTube of my testing Andrew's hypnotizability. And if you haven't seen it, it's fun.
Because he's quite hypnotizable.
Yeah, I'm giving him the hypnotic induction profile. Yeah. And here's this big, tough, bearded guy, right?
Yeah.
And I stroke his hand and say it's going to float up in the air like a balloon. And it floats up and he's looking at it like, what the hell is going on here? You know? So, you know, the fact that you can, in control, experience discontrol of a part of your body tells you there's something unusual and powerful going on here. Let's see what we can learn about it. And it isn't frightening, it's intriguing. Mm. And so you use it as a way of saying you are now capable of going into a different state of consciousness that we can use together to help you deal with problems. And if you can separate your arm from the rest of your body, you can separate that part of you that went through this misery years ago from the rest of you too, and teach you how to put it into perspective. And whenever you've had enough, we can stop it. See, that's the other thing. If you're just, you know, getting into a drunken conversation late at night with a friend about some horrible experience, God knows when it'll end.
Yeah.
If you do it in a controlled setting where you're just exploring something, shifting your attention, getting into a different mental state, keeping your body comfortable and picturing parts of it in a controlled way, you're in control. You're not being beaten up or victimized again. You're in control. And so the process doesn't reinforce the content. In fact, it contradicts the content. You can remember it, but you can be in control of it. And you're not the person now that you were when that happened. And so that kind of reassurance, it makes it a therapeutic context, not a triggering context.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you said that, it's kind of like, you know, my little concept of the emotional signature in the insula, you know, feeling the same way as now that you did as a 6-year-old who was being yelled at her mother. You know, if you can go in, if you can actually sit there like the hand and look at that situation, or even look at the pattern that's created by that in your body, in your system, and go, oh, this isn't all of me. Right?
Right.
This is part of me that by definition I can separate from. And if I can separate from and it's separable, it can't be all of me. And I think that's so much with trauma is when people go into that sort of unconscious trauma state is they believe it was all of them because as a child it was. There was no way out, right? So we go back into that and then our prefrontal cortex or our cortex gets paralyzed and we lose the ability to see that this isn't all of us. And I think that hypnosis gives us that idea of being able to kind of step outside and kind of see that this is different. This is not the same.
Right. That's exactly right. That's why we put Reverie out there is for people to learn that they can control these alterations in their experience of themselves, their consciousness, take things that made them overwhelmingly anxious and just face them. Just look at them and not be overwhelmed by them. So that people with phobias can, I had a woman recently who had obsessive compulsive disorder and claustrophobia, has cancer now and has to get into a PET scanner, scared to death. Mm-hmm. But she was able to picture her beloved sister being with her, and experience the comforting that her sister gave her. And even if the sister wasn't there.
Yeah.
And she came out of it just right after and said, you know, I think I can do it. I could, for the first time, picture myself comforting my body rather than just contributing to the fear. And you, so you can try being a different person and see what it would feel like and feel better doing it right away.
Yeah. And I think that people, this is one of the things that I run into with people, is that they will start to feel better. Like they'll say, I'm not as anxious. And then they'll say to me things like, you know what? I'm starting to get worried because I'm not worried. Right. And that, and I think the way I describe it is kind of like, escaping from a prison camp and then, you know, getting, and then seeing that there's a mountain, you know, a 2000 foot mountain you've got to climb. It's like, oh, I thought I was past this. But, you know, that protective ego is so powerful that it assumes that your worries are keeping you safe. Right. That's the linchpin of this whole thing. Yeah. So when you start moving away from worry, you're moving away from this old friend in quotation marks that you believed unconsciously was keeping you safe. So there is this sort of blip after you start feeling better. And this is where the ego drags people back into the old sort of worry pattern, because it's such a groove. You know, I call it a toboggan groove in the snow. You go down once, twice, three, four times, you're going down faster, it's deeper. It's very hard to pull the toboggan out of that groove. And it's just learning that you can see things in a different way. And once you start feeling safe, that's you can, you know, bring that back. You can actually have that felt sense through the insula and through other places. Like, there's a felt sense that I'm safe. Now I have a place that I can build this on. Because what I see with a lot of cognitive therapy is they work for 3 months. And then a year later, they come to see me and go, yeah, I did, you know, $5,000 with the CBT. It seemed to help at the time, but now I'm more anxious than even I was back then.
Well, you know, one of the most damaging things about trauma like that is that people in general would rather feel guilty than helpless.
Mm.
You know, the thing about trauma is you're made into an object, a thing. You have no control of your body. And people would rather tell themselves a story. Well, you know, I should have known better than walk to the drugstore at 2 p.m. when, you know, an attack happened, as if she could have known that was going to happen. And so the guilt keeps you sort of replaying that as if you could have played it differently. And if you can face the fact that there were moments when you were in fact helpless, which is terrifying,
mm-hmm.
but doesn't mean that you should blame yourself for it happening, or you should keep retrying the situation to see if you can get it right, which often happens. You just experience it as accepting your helplessness at that moment, picture what you did to protect yourself and survive it, and then move on. And that it's a way of facing how bad it was, but letting yourself off the hook.
Right. Because so much I see in my patients is this confirmation bias. I feel worried. It's like almost like Descartes. I think, therefore I am. I feel worried, therefore I am worried. And then the brain, you know, being a meaning-making, make-sense machine, has to do so. Well, if only I took a different route. If only I did this. If only I did that. And it's just, you're never, I'm not going to swear, but, you know, it's this sort of mind F that you know, you get stuck into, but because it makes sense, your mesocortical and mesolimbic dopamine system goes, this makes sense. This worry makes sense. You're making something that's uncertain a little more certain, which gives you that little dopamine hit, which I'm on the right track. And that's one of the things I think that why worry becomes so addictive. And I think the PAG, you know, starts creating endorphins and enkephalins. Like, the more you scare yourself with worry, I think there is this kind of area where it's almost like a runner's high, like you're pounding yourself on the pavement, but you're creating these endogenous enkephalins and endorphins. So it just makes the worry even more ingrained in your system.
Yeah. Well, you feel good about anticipating feeling bad, and it's a vicious cycle. It just keeps going. That's right. It doesn't fix it. It just continues it.
So tell me more about Reverie. Like, why did you start it?
So I was talking at a brain mind summit at Stanford about 4 years ago, and this guy, Ariel Poehler, who's our co-founder and is a serial entrepreneur, he helped to build Strava, which is a terrific exercise app. said, hey, David, you know, you say hypnosis can help people stop smoking. You want to build an Alexa app and see if it works? And at the time, Alexa was making it very easy to do these voice interaction things. And so I said, great, let's do it. So we built the app together and got it running. And it was sort of clunky and difficult to log on. And people didn't like their speakers listening to them all day and all that. But we got 19% to stop smoking. And the remainder decreased their amount of smoking by about half. And we thought, what the hell? This is actually working. And we have had no problems. You know, one woman said, who joined the study, said, the first time I tried it, I really didn't like it. I've smoked for 25 years. I didn't even want to stop smoking. And that night, she said, I went home a little bit. I tried the exercise again for my body. Smoking's a poison. I need my body to live. I owe my body respect and protection. So we don't talk about the urge at all. We talk about being a good parent to your own body. Mm. You wouldn't put tar and nicotine smoke into the lungs of your baby. Don't do it to your body because it's as dependent on you as your baby is. And she said, I lit up a cigarette. I looked at it and I said, feck, who needs this? And I put it out. I have not had a cigarette since. My friends can't believe it. And she said to me, this is some crazy ass voodoo shit. And I mean that in a good way. She said, you know, and she's helping her friends stop. And so, you know, we found that but Ariel said to me, David, this platform is not, you know, it was great to help us try it, but it's not going to work. So we built our own app and we have a great little company now with 16 people working with us. We've had 500,000 downloads. We have any one time about 22,000 people using it actively. And it makes me feel so good, Russ, that talking to you, I'm helping more people than I did in 6 months of face-to-face clinical work. I love it. I'm still doing it. But I just wanted to spread the wealth. We've learned enough about this state. And, you know, hypnosis has been sort of the Rodney Dangerfield of psychotherapies. You know, he said I don't get no respect. Yep. He asked me to leave a bar so they could start happy hour, you know. And I want that to change because I know how much this can help people. And I wanted to make it as available as I could to as many people as I can. And that's why we're doing it.
That's amazing. You know, and that's basically why I wrote my book too. It's to say, I want to get it out there as much as I can. I've got a program that I put out there. It's $100. It's not like one of these $1,000 programs, whatever. Right. But you say Rodney Dangerfield. So my old stand-up comedy thing, because it's,
hey, I went to my doctor. He told me I had 6 months to live. I said, I want a second opinion. He says, okay, you're ugly too.
That's good. That's great.
So yeah, it's just, you know, it is one of those things that like, and that's what I talk about too, is becoming this sort of parent, as cliche and kind of woo as it sounds, it's becoming this parent to yourself and seeing this wounded child. Like I get people to put a picture of themselves at the time of their trauma up on their bathroom mirror, if it isn't too traumatizing, and connect with it every day. Just connect with, just even say, hey, how's it going? I'm going to have a pee, right? They just like, just getting into that sense, because I believe that anxiety fundamentally is this adult self, child self disconnect. The adult doesn't want to go back to the child because the child holds all their pain. And the child doesn't trust the adult in us because we've been ignoring them for like decades. And then this mind-body disconnect too. So it's this combination. So to heal anxiety, it's like bringing the mind and the body together and bringing the adult self and the child self back together, which hypnosis actually does both.
Well, I got to tell you a story about that. So I saw this guy, very responsible, civic official, nice man, lovely father, and had terrific kids, had terrible lower back pain. He was a big, tall guy and had some disc disease. And he came originally for the pain, but Christmas was coming up. And he told me, I always dread Christmas. And I said, why? He said, my father was an abusive drunk, and he got at his worst. He'd drink more on Christmas Day. He'd break presents. He'd break the things on the mantelpiece. And so we always had a duck, you know. And he said, toward the end of the session, he said, I have to go somewhere. And I said, where's that? He said, well, my father is dead now, and he's buried up in that cemetery near San Francisco, and I got to go there and decorate his grave. And I said, what in the hell are you doing that for? You're going to decorate the grave of that bastard? I mean, yes, he's biologically responsible for your being on Earth, but beyond that, you know, all he owes you is an apology. You know, you don't owe him anything. And he said, really? I said, yeah, don't go. Don't do it. You know, every year he'd done that, you know, just a decent, you know, he was like the opposite. He was being the opposite of what his father was. And he was a loving father and very successful at his work and all that, but sad and in pain. So he was controlling his pain. And the thing that strikes me in what you said, Russ, is he came back the next time and he said, you know, Doc, I looked at my picture and for the first time in my life, I liked what I saw. And so I thought, yep, I did the right thing, you know. And he got it, you know, he got it.
And often it takes practice, you know, because you look at that. When I first started doing this with a picture of Rusty when I was about 13 or so, there was this sort of, almost like, you know, the insula lights up with disgust, right? Like that's that's one of the things. And I think that we create this sort of disgusting version of our child, right? It's like, well, we don't want to go there. But when you bring that child into the fold and you start breaking through that sort of disgusting, quote unquote, resistance, you just start seeing an innocent child. And then one of the things that I say to people all the time is, you know, can you tell that child that the very best parts of you came from them? The very best part, my generosity, my sensitivity, all that stuff comes from him. So it's just, again, it's kind of like your thing about just changing the narrative or changing the, you know, the behavioral sort of influence around it. You know, that's I think how we change it. And then play too, like with I have this one woman I was talking to in Toronto, and I said, what did you do when you were younger? For fun, like what did you do to feel grounded in yourself? She said, well, I would go to the swings down the street from my, and it's like, well, you still live in the same house that you did 40 years ago. Are the swings still there? And she says, yeah. And I said, well, this afternoon you go on the swings and you have a little chat with her about how much fun this is to go on the swings. And she sent me a text later saying, I have never cried so much in my entire life as when I was on that thing, connecting with that younger version of me. You know, so, and play is so important. You know, one of the things that I see about trauma is that trauma kind of activates the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. It's like co-activation. So it's like having your foot on the gas and the brake at the same time. The other thing that does that, and this is kind of like going back and visiting the same thing, is play, because play activates parasympathetic and sympathetic at the same time. So in play, you have this sort of fertile area where you can actually bring in. So I can see, you know, bringing in play to trauma. You know, just saying, like, can we play with this car accident? Can we play with this, you know, abusive alcoholic father? Can we play with this? Because in the same sort of thing with hypnosis, getting into this safe place and then experiencing it and then being safe and experienced, it's the same kind of thing. So I don't want to hijack this because I just love this conversation. But what I wanted to get back to is what do people, can people use Reverie for?
I'll just say one other thing, that you were also modeling her being a better parent to her child. And what you can help people do is show them how, if she could actually just go to the swings, not to escape the misery in her home, but just to enjoy it.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing. And you helped her do that, you know?
Yeah.
So Reverie, we have programs for stress management, for focus, for getting to sleep or getting back to sleep. I used to worry that Reverie wouldn't be as good as being in my office. And then I realized that in some ways it's better, because if you wake up at 3 a.m. and want hypnosis to go back to sleep, you don't want me in your bedroom showing you how to do it. You know? So you can just use the app. We use it for dealing with phobias and controlling pain. It's very useful. We have 4 different programs for pain control. We use it to help people stop smoking, stop vaping, control drinking, and also to eat more sensibly, to focus on eating with respect for your body and eating, if you want to control the amount you eat, to enjoy eating more even as you eat less, to think about eating like a gourmet and getting more pleasure out of eating less, if that's what your goal is. So those are the kinds of things that
that's great.
Help people with.
That's amazing, because I think people really need some help these days. And there's so many things out there that kind of break my heart about, you know, cure your PTSD in a week, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, it took years for that to get in there. And these things don't work. These cognitive things just don't, they may work in the short term, but they don't work in the long term. I've been using self-hypnosis for many years. I used to play snooker at a competitive level, and I used to hypnotize myself when I was you know, 21 years old, which is like 40 years ago now. Cool. And I also, I have a little studio upstairs in my house that I make recordings. And the little studio is also known as my wife's walk-in closet. But I have a little studio in there that I, you know, have it soundproof. And I make these tracks for myself, like things that I want to work on for myself. And then I put binaural beats behind them. And then what I'll do is I'll start with the whole thing about starting your right side, right thumb, right index finger, right third finger, right fourth finger, and I go through the whole thing that way. And then about three quarters of the way through, I do this guided imagery. You know, imagine a desert fox. Imagine a willowy tree. Imagine a snow-capped mountain. Imagine the sound of popcorn. So I try and use all the different sensations, the sound of popcorn popping. And that seems to kind of bring everything in at the end. And in my program, I have this thing called the Yoga Nidra, which kind of, you know, takes people in through that because I'm a yoga teacher as well. So it is one of those things that I think that hypnosis has been one of the things in my life that's been so helpful at just connecting me with myself.
I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah, it's funny, the paradox that by disconnecting, you reconnect. The dissociation helps you appreciate yourself from a different perspective and reconnect. And I think it does that.
And you're not losing control. That's
reconnect.
And you're not losing control at all. In fact, you're gaining control. And I think that's one of the main things that I got from just listening to you. It's like, this is a way of gaining control over your life, not being, you know, some sort of football coach who's dancing around like a ballerina.
Exactly. So, exactly.
Thank you so much, Dr.
You're
Spiegel.
Most welcome,
like, I so appreciated talking with you. You're welcome to come back to the show anytime. Terrific. And I would love to chat with you again. Thanks very much, David.
You're most welcome, Russ. Thanks for what you're doing, and I appreciate being here.
You too. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.